Welcome to the Protectors Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Piccolo.
Hey, I'd like to welcome to the show Steve Powell. You may have heard him on a Chad Prather show. You may have heard him pretty much everywhere on my social media. So welcome, Steve. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm glad to have you. Because this show revolves around protectors, you know, the people that, you know, LEOs, veterans, military, and also, you know, those who support them. And not only are you a veteran, but you also do a ton to support veterans. And that's what's really cool about having you on.
We really try to help as many veterans organizations as we can, especially once we find out they're legit and we know that, hey, we can see direct, we can see action happen and being done. So that's really kind of our deal. We want to get behind and support, and if nothing else, use our platform to help get the word out, along with doing, you know, events and stuff like that with different organizations.
Yeah, that's one thing I really dig about, like, the vetting. You know, there's so many people out there right now trying to raise money. You don't know if they always have the right intentions. And it's kind of cool when you guys find the right one and you can really push it out and get some optics on it.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think off the top of my head, and I can't think of it. And I should know this. We just had a guy on the podcast the other day that he does all these incredible stunts, like base jumping and stuff like that. His name is I think it's Ryan Birdman Parrott.
And yeah, we'll take a look.
We got to take a look at that. And anyway, but he does. Their organization, they get these other military and veteran ran fundraisers and stuff to make sure they're legit.
That's really good. I know they have all these 4-star charity navigators, but not everybody is in that. Not everybody is a 513 or whatever you call that, or 503C. So you need people to actually go out there and vet. So, like, when something comes up, you're not, like, just going down a rabbit hole, throwing all this money and resources out to find out they're just, you know, a wannabe or something.
Yeah, that's what I'm pulling up on my laptop, because I do want to get to, at some point, I do want to find this thing so I can give you, you know,
I'll definitely link to him after the podcast.
All right,
let's talk about the Steve Pal. Where did Steve come from?
Oh, where do you want to start? Let's start the East Texas town, Corrigan, Texas, population 1,500.
Wow.
It's my dad was the chief of police and my mom was a high school English teacher my entire life.
That's like Norman Rockwell right there.
Yeah. It's like, you know, small town, you know, everybody knows your business. Everybody knew what I was doing before I ever got home. My mom and dad knew where I'd been and what I'd been doing before I ever got home on a Friday night. It's kind of hilarious. And if we want to jump to Marine Corps and how I got there, that's a fun story there.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Small town
boy goes to the Marine Corps.
Yeah, my dad was a Marine, so there's a start. I wish I could say I went because my dad was a Marine and all that kind of stuff, and that'd be like, oh, wow, yeah, you followed your dad's footsteps and just went right into the Marine Corps at young age and that kind of thing to go conquer the world. But that's not quite the case. I went the opposite route you could go. I took a little tractor for a joyride. I was 18 years old. Me and some buddies took a tractor for a joyride. Well, little did I know, that's a third-degree felony. And there I was standing in front of the district attorney of Tyler, Texas, who happened to be a former Marine. And he says, son, I'm going to give you two options. Option number one, we're going to go forth and file these charges and you're going to go to jail. Option number two is you go join the Marine Corps. I chose option number two. I went to the Marine Corps. I was like, I'm not going to jail. And I don't even know if they still do that anymore. But anyway, I went in the Marine Corps and I served 4 years. I went in and I guess that was 1990. That was summer of 1990.
Oh, wow.
Literally nothing was going on. We were, peacetime. I go through boot camp at MCRD San Diego, leave there and go to North Carolina for motor T school, a diesel mechanic. I thought I wanted to be a diesel mechanic. And I'm out in town in Jacksonville, North Carolina, and I'm doing laundry. I'm sitting at a bar, the bar that you can drink beer while you're running your clothes through the washer and dryer and stuff. And a number pops up on a big screen whenever your washer's done. So you're all in there drinking beer, watching whatever sports, and breaking news comes on. And that was and here we are, this is 2001. I mean, 91. I always say 2001. Somebody asks me something and I get mixed up. It's 91. I'm old. And so this was 91, and this was, here we are going into Kuwait and all that's going on. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm not even finished. I'm just barely finishing, my basic school. And I get, within a couple of weeks, I get orders to go to Cherry Point, North Carolina, Air Station. I mean, this is, if you go in the Marine Corps and you go to Air Station, that's cake. That's like, skating by. I was like, man, I got it made. As soon as I get over there, I'm there a short time, and they TAD me, temporary assigned duty, to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. I go to 22nd MU, Marine Expeditionary Unit, that I got deployed for a year, or temporarily assigned duty over to Camp Lejeune, which ended up being a 6-month deployment in the Persian Gulf.
Oh, wow.
And I was aboard the USS Saipan, which is a big flat bottom boat full of Marines.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, it was fun. But by the time that I got to the Persian Gulf, and by the time we got to Kuwait, everything was done and over. By the time we got over there, we went to the Suez Canal in October. I mean, this is, months later. But it took that long to get, when you go on deployment, it takes months to get everything ready to go unless you're, on some, extreme rapid deployment kind of deal. But we were not.
So was it eventful? Or, I mean, what was it like?
It was totally uneventful. I got to go into Kuwait. I went all the way up the Highway of Death. Of course, we were, at that time, it had already, for the most part, everything. We did some clearing and some stuff like that and cleaned some stuff out and that kind of thing. But I really wasn't too involved. I was there in a vehicle because, it's Motor T.
Yeah.
but I did get to drive. We drove all the way up and saw the Iraq border from about, 10 or 12 miles away. And that was
pretty cool.
We got. And we our unit set up dental and medical facilities for the Bedouins.
Oh wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, so every day I was going to that med dental facility, giving rides back and forth to sergeant major, first sergeant, whoever, that kind of deal, kind of on the driver detail. I got to see a lot of stuff, but I really didn't do anything. They gave me 10 rounds. I had 10 rounds in a magazine. They called them safety rounds, but I could not put one in the chamber.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. A lot of people don't realize it, but there's Bedouins all over Kuwait. Some are driving around in the desert there and you're like, what?
Oh yeah. We would have the Bedouins who would drive the camels through a camp every morning and every evening.
That's awesome.
I don't know if they were doing it on purpose or if
they
just set up in their natural, you know, route, which they took.
That's awesome. So you get back from Kuwait, and what was the rest of your Marines like? Was it just kind of like just chill?
No. I'm still going. I get back from there, and I was I go back to Cherry Point, and I'm back at Cherry Point, and they sent me to another school to for wrecker vehicle recovery mechanic, which is basically a tow truck driver.
Did you get to drive the big truck? What was that? The big truck.
I didn't drive the Amtrak. So I drove what they the big LVS, the big logistic,
giant
23.5-ton wrecker.
Wow.
And that's what I drove every day for a little, okay, one, two. So we're year number three. That was year number three. And I'm sitting at, they have what they call overseas control dates, which means if you have a certain amount of time left, you don't have to go on another deployment.
Mm-hmm.
I was 27 days away from my overseas control date, and I spent my last year in Okinawa. So I go to Okinawa. Of course, Okinawa is, you know, that's just it's an island for Marines to go party. And
oh my god,
I get it's the day that I checked into my unit, and just a maintenance battalion. They said, oh, well, you're going TAD with MSSG 31. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. What's that mean? Oh, 31st U is gearing up to go on deployment.
Oh, man.
So they, I go back on a ship for 6 months. And I did the Australia, the Indonesia, and just you name it, a country in that area, I've been to.
That's kind of cool, though. I mean, at least you saw something, you know, coming from a small town in Texas. Just like if you didn't steal that tractor, you never would have been in Japan.
That's right. I think if my last count was, while I was in the Marine Corps, was about 28 countries.
Oh, man.
That I spent no less than 5 days. And most of the time when you go in, you run on a ship and you go into port, you're there for 10 days.
Yeah, my military career was the United States, Kuwait, and Iraq. I'm like, wow, 28 other countries would have been nice.
Yeah. So I kind of joke about it because I'm like, I missed Desert Storm. I was Desert Cleanup. And so I always kind of joke about it. I always went wherever it seemed like I would go somewhere that was really cool and where everybody else wanted to go.
That's pretty cool though, man. So why didn't you re-enlist?
I was just done.
I could not know that feeling.
At that time I was ready to go home. And by the time that I was left Okinawa, I had a baby on the way. And which is awesome. She's 25 and she's in the Army and her husband's in the Army. Yeah. So
that's the one thing I give you, like your kids are awesome, man. They're all like, well, you're just not that you're not awesome, but you know, I met your son and stuff for you. And it's really, really great kids, man.
Yeah, he's something else. I'm super proud of him too. He's in the Army Reserves, and he finishes up his bachelor's degree in criminal justice this year. So he's got three classes and he's done.
That's awesome.
And my middle daughter is her husband's in the Navy, and they are stationed right now in Oklahoma City. He wires aircraft on Tinker Air Force Base.
Huh. That's really cool, man. So what happened when you get out? I mean, now you had to raise a family. So you're getting out of the Marines.
I was getting out of the Marine Corps, and I was instant family, and I get home and I had zero plans because, man, you get out of the service, and back then there was no transition or anything like that. You just got out and they sent you back and they gave you a check and plane ticket home. And I flew from Okinawa. I landed in California, and I was at Pendleton for a week and a half, and then I was home.
Wow.
And I was like, goodness. And it's funny. I had a great, I don't know if he was a great uncle or a distant cousin that passed away. And I just got home, and it's like my dad and mom and dad said, well, we're going to his funeral. Welcome to come along, that kind of thing like that. And I'm like, oh, okay. I hadn't seen anybody in like forever. And I go to the funeral, and my dad's like, hey, that's so-and-so. He works offshore. He's a directional driller. And I have no idea what he's talking about. And 2 weeks later, I was working offshore on drilling rigs.
You've got the Texas story down pat, man. You were like, you know, small town, you know, Marines come back. Now you're out the on the rigs, man. It's just,
yeah, I'm out there on the rigs, and I'm back on the water. it's kind of funny. So then, you know, I did that through one marriage, which was a short marriage. And which I, you know, the three oldest kids, you know, I gained, you know, I cannot be like more. I have zero regrets, and where that's concerned. And so anyway, fast forward a little bit. When I went through that divorce, I quit working offshore, stay home to, you know, raise my. I moved in with my mom and dad with three kids. It's kind of
insane. Oh wow,
yeah, and. A little while later, I met my wife, whose dad was 32-year Army Sergeant Major.
Oh, my gosh.
And let me tell you, you talk to her about 5 minutes and you know it. I like to take a lot of credit for the kids, but it's probably her that is – she's more drill instructor than – I could ever.
Because I was wondering, I'm like, where did the Army come out of this Marine family?
Yeah, I don't know.
And I'm like, we're going to follow after stepmom. You know, sorry about that.
I asked my son, I said, well, why not the Marine Corps? I said, Dad, that's too tough. I said, you're right. And, but maybe smarter than I was. I don't know.
Oh, man. So now you're raising your kids. How did this whole Chad Prather thing come into effect?
Well, okay. Well, if we don't, let's not if we jump that far, it's not time.
That's
to jump
that's
that
a
far,
that's definitely not time because that's like yeah. You know, a decade down. Well,
so at 20, at this time, I'm like 28 or 29 years old. I'm just like the the first 20 or 29 years of my life. I was like, man, I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up. It's like, what am I going to do? So I decide to, I have the GI Bill. I have Texas Hazelwood Act. And I'm like, man, I can go to school. And I'm like, at that time, you know, I'm remarried. We're raising the kids. We moved to San Antonio. And I told my wife, I says, well, I can go back to school. Cause she got a really good job there. At that time, I guess I'm trying to, if I'm not skipping years, that she was at Brooke Army Medical Center as a nurse. And I was like, well, shoot, I'll go to nursing school. I can do that. I've been living, you know, we've been married. I kind of get a feel for it every day. And so I start doing all the prerequisites for nursing school. I finish them, get accepted into nursing program. And I came home and I said, I don't want to be a nurse. And she's like, what? So she kind of was like, you just went to school for 2 years and now you're saying you don't want to do this?
Huh. Wow.
And I'm like, no, I don't think I want to do it. And so we started like scrambling out. What am I going to do? What are we going to use all this schooling for? And there in San Antonio, the Baptist health system had a surgical technologist program that I had all the everything, prereqs for nursing school are pretty much the same. And so I was like, because I didn't want to be a nurse. I don't think I wanted that responsibility. And I really think it came down to responsibility. And I was like, I just don't want the responsibility of, you know, someone's life in my hands. And I gained a big respect for my wife, you know, going through all this. And so I went into the surgical technologist program and became a surgical technologist and worked in the operating room for a number of years.
Now, what does a surgical technologist do?
They are scrubbed in the case. They are they set up all the instruments and
everything
for the surgeons and pass the instruments to the surgeons and very limited assisting in surgery as far as actual doing things other than holding stuff out of the way and things like that. And I did that for several years, and 5 or 6 years, and I got extremely bored. And at the same time I was doing that, and this is where the story even turns funnier, is my wife's uncle raises racing greyhounds, and I started kind of helping him on the side and raised a litter of dogs for myself and put them on the track. And it just turns out I got really lucky on that very first litter, and 9 of them go to the top track in the United States. Well, that allowed me to quit my day job.
Oh my gosh.
And I started doing that. I had a greyhound farm of 120 dogs from, I guess that's somewhere at 2000 to about 2009. Economy kind of started going to crap. Dog tracks started shutting down. Customers stopped paying bills. And it's like, oh my goodness, I've got to go back to work. Well, kind of at that same time, one of my musician buddies, he's like, hey, man, why don't you come out on the road with me and help me out. He sells some T-shirts and that kind of stuff. And I ended up being his tour manager for 6 years, doing anything from selling T-shirts to driving to, you know, scheduling shows and doing all the advancement of all the kind of shows. And somewhere in there, I ran into Chad, and I ran into Chad multiple times. He would come to shows and stuff like that. And he used to tell me, and this is probably about six or seven years ago, he said, dude, one of these days I'm going to hire you. And I'm like, man, I don't even know what you do. And I used to laugh at him. And I laughed him off 3 or 4 times. And I guess it's been about 2.5 years ago. I know it's been about, I would say 3.5 years ago. I was tired of that. I just got burned out. I was done. You see a pattern here?
Yeah.
I was like, I was just going nowhere. It was like, it just seems like, oh, I'm just doing the same thing over and over again. And there's so much potential and growth here, but it's just not going anywhere. And I just burned out again. And so me and my wife decided to pack up our house, sell everything off, and she was going to travel nurse because she wanted to travel in the United States. So we did that. We did exactly that. The 3 older kids were grown, out of house, 1 in college, 2, you know, everybody's grown up now except for our 15-year-old. She's still at home now. We pulled her out of school, started homeschooling her, and we started traveling. And our first place we traveled to, because we didn't want to go too far, was San Angelo, Texas. And, which in some places you'd drive across 2 states, but in Texas it's just a, you know, full day's drive. And we did that. We went from there. I think we were there 4 months, and then we went up to Billings, Montana. And I, at this point, I hadn't heard from Chad in probably a year or so. And he calls me. He's like, "Dude, where are you at? What are y'all doing?" Because, you know, I post our adventures on Facebook and everything we're doing. We're getting to see the United States. And I told him, I said, "Dude, I just burned out. My brain's fried from stress and everything else. I just got to do something. So we're traveling." He says, "Well, you know, I'm going to need you. I told you I was going to hire you." I said, "Okay, well, call me when you're ready to put me to work. He said, I'm going to. And man, I talked to him probably every month for the next year. We had talked, you know, and he's like, well, this is what I got going on. This is this and that. And then thinking it was late 2015 when he had that first viral video.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, wait, what is he doing? Well, in 16, he started, he started touring with a comedian and putting some of his antics and his stories and, you know, funny things and doing these live performances. And I think they did about, I think he did about 30 dates in 2016, maybe more than that, but I could be wrong. But he would call me and say, man, I'm about to need you. I said, well, you call me when you're ready. He says, how about this? How about you just, I think at that time we were in Michigan and we had done 6 or 7 months up in Michigan. And he says, how about I just fly you down here and you meet me and you just see what you think about this. And to me, I'm like, man, there's something's going on. This is weird. He is just going through all these efforts, and it's like, man, there's a 100 guys right here in, you know, in this Fort Worth area that he could hire to do this.
But how many can he actually trust, you know?
Yeah, I know, but I was like, I was kind of skeptical, and he said, well, just come on, fly out here and do this, and I'm like, okay. So the next thing I know, I get an email, and there's my plane ticket. And I'm like, well, I guess he means it. So we fly out and we do this live show for 1,500 people.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh my goodness. Okay. I see. And then we go from Michigan. My wife goes to South Carolina to work. And he flew me out of South Carolina the entire time. I was barely there in South Carolina. He just every 3 or 4 days I was back there, say hi to the girls, and then I'm back out and I'm doing live shows. And I think that year we ended up doing 95 live shows.
Whoa.
Not counting private events and stuff like that. And so here we are in 2019 and I'm still doing it. I'm loving it. I haven't got burned out, and it's a new place every few days. We're doing about 95 dates, live shows, this year. Along with everything else that we're doing, we do we're Blaze TV Humor Me. He has the TV show that we have a film crew that goes with us all the time and always filming our antics and stuff we're doing. Of course, the podcast. We do the podcast 4 days a week. And sometimes those are pre-recorded because we can't be home.
Or sometimes you get people like me that fly in on a Sunday and have to do it.
Yeah. Hey, and we sure accommodate, like, especially like that is to, you know, hey, we'll go in on Sunday and do it. We don't mind it because if somebody calls tonight and this is the only time that we could meet him, we'd go. If he wasn't on vacation right now, and he's taking a week in Ireland, so just to get away and left me here to do work, which is okay. I'm good with that.
Well, you know, that's one thing I got, both of you guys. You're such a good team. And there's a really good dynamic there. And you can see that it's like, you know, coming in as a guest and then seeing how you guys just mold and meld, and you can kind of see where, you know, he's been like scoping you out for all these years saying, hey, you know what? You're not like just a manager. You're kind of like part of the show. I mean, I love it.
He has definitely brought me in and made me a part of the show and part of his brand and, you know, and just gradually increasing it all the time. And I'm like, no, I can't never go on camera. I could never. I don't like the sound of my voice when it's recorded. I can name you 1,000 excuses I've made. And here I am doing it. And we were having a conversation. It's on one of the episodes of Humor Me. And, you know, growing up in a small town, and there's this guy who would make fun of the way I talked. And I'm just using that as an example because this is a true story, that when I was a kid, he would make fun of the way I talked. About three or four months ago, I get a message on Facebook. He says, "Dude, I love what y'all are doing. I listen to every show." And that just cracked me up.
Yeah.
Like, and then I say, "Hey, you need to subscribe to Blaze TV and watch Humor Me."
Well, I didn't know much about you, you know, until I met you guys. And, you know, I always thought you came from like an entertainment background. I thought this was all part of the thing. But, you know, if you meet, like, you know, you and Chad and everybody, you're like, this is just almost like a family just chilling, talking, and not, you know, just, you know, not making things up. They're really this authentic.
That's kind of been the whole basis all along of anything that we do, is just keep it as real. When I asked him, I said, I still ask him this day, I said, "Well, why did you pick me?" He says, "Because I wanted you to come and do what you did for those other bands that you worked for, and I will appreciate you. I see what they don't see, and I know what you bring to the team." And it was like, and sometimes I still question it. And we had the video crew at my house this morning to come over here while Chad's out of town, and we're trying to do the monologue for the show. Of course, it's a riot because I can't keep up with a teleprompter. and I know they purposely put some big words in on this monologue for me to mispronounce and mess up. It's hilarious.
That's awesome.
I can't wait. That'll air tomorrow on Humor Me. I can't wait to see how bad I look.
I'm sure you're doing great, man. I mean, that's those guys make me look good. They can make anybody look good.
Yeah, that's we were out there. I had so much fun when we were at CPAC, and I'm out in the lobby of CPAC with a microphone. I'm doing kind of like the man on the street kind of interviews with people. And I was like, and I got through and I said, "Gosh, that's horrible. I'm sorry, guys." And they couldn't be more excited. And when I watched it, I actually was like, "Oh, wow, they can do some really good cuts and edit and make anybody look good."
Nah, you're getting good at it, man. You're comfortable on the camera. You're comfortable behind the mic.
Yeah, I'm getting there. I don't know if I'm comfortable or I just go in there and I fake it real good or take a couple of shots of whiskey.
Aren't we all faking it a little bit? So let's talk about what you got coming up. Now, you and I are both excited. We got the Ireland trip. I think I might be jumping on board with that if you want to kind of go into
that a little bit.
That is
the Texas Red Dirt Pub Crawl. And what it is, it's a big group because it's musicians. They're Texas country artists. And probably one of the big ones that are on this one is Copper Chief. They were on that show with, I think it's Travis Tritt, where they judge the stuff, contest. And they went real far in it. And they're on that trip. And then there's several other artists on there. And it's funny because these artists I've worked for in some capacity, probably about four of them or five of them I've worked for over the years in some capacity. Sometimes it would be just going out and, "Hey, I'm off this weekend," and they would have me come out and sell T-shirts, or, "Hey, I have an acoustic gig. Can you drive me to this and take care of all the merchandise?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure thing." And so I would kind of do that for several of these guys. And they Red Dirt Pub Crawl asked if Chad and I would like to join them in Ireland. And we said, "Sure thing, let's do it."
That's awesome. I am very excited for that one. I think you almost got me talked into doing it.
Hey, November 9th to the 16th.
That sounds good to me.
And my wife can't be more excited because she gets to go too. They have it where you can make payments, and I've almost got it paid for.
And, you know, I'll link that to the podcast as well.
Oh, great. That'd be good.
That'd be really cool. Well, Steve, you are an excellent guest. Is there anything you want to plug, promote, talk about?
I don't know. I've plugged the Ireland trip, but go out and see a Chad Prather show, and you'll see me running around. I cut up. I go out in the lobby before the show. If I'm not the one, we usually have someone selling merchandise, but I'm still out there with it, and I'm out there cutting up with Chad, you know, and having a ball with him in the lobby.
Yeah, we're definitely doing that. Chad. We're going to follow you. Now, do you have your own site, or do you Facebook, any social media?
Yeah. Everything is Party Foul Steve.
Okay. And next podcast, we'll get into where the Party Foul Steve came from.
Oh yeah, that's a long story. Actually, it's really short, but that's So it's all great. Everybody's had a party foul or two. I've had dozens.
Well, I definitely want to have you back. And, man, this is cool. I like having you on, man.
Well, good. Thank you for having me. And I know we're going to get you back on ours.
Yeah, next time I'm in Texas. I love good Texas, man. I love it.
Yep.
Well, good. Thanks a lot, Steve.
All right. Thank you, and take care.